Talk given on Saturday, July 17th, 1971. Have we all solved all our problems now? Loud laughter. If not, why not? Have we not considered this matter sufficiently, deeply? Seen the ways? What is there lacking still? Maybe two or three important things. A sufficiently intense longing for enlightenment, for liberation. Buddhism presents it as the arousing of the bodhicitta, the longing for enlightenment, not merely the thought, cold, impersonal, ineffective often, but the real longing for it. In the Hindu world, perhaps Shankara expressed it in one single word, mumuksha, the longing for liberation. The real passionate longing for liberation. Way back in the Upanishads, they talked of it. The one and only thing that one may long for, Brahman, the ultimate reality. Perhaps that is still not strong enough in us. That is one reason, the root reason, maybe. And then, our own immediate task, as far as we ourselves are concerned. You remember what we considered last time we met. This question of not taking sides when the contradictions arise. Why shouldn't we take sides when the contradictions arise? Because then we are caught in the conflict engendered by ill-understood duels in opposition to each other. But if we do not take sides and steadily look at all the factors involved, then understanding of all the factors involved grows. And in the light of that understanding, which is always accompanied by compassion, profound compassion, harmony can be brought into the situation. Let us consider for a moment, what exactly do we mean by our problems? What is a problem? How and when does a problem for me, the individual, arise? The world process, which is a process of continuous change according to the forces at play, will always, invariably and inevitably present challenges to those individuals who are in a particular situation. It will always do that. In the ordinary way, I look at the challenge and say, this is my problem. But why do I say that? My mind has been so conditioned that the word challenge means something which is opposing me, which is inimical to me, which I must fight against. But is not that the view and the attitude of those who are not yet fully human? We forget that in actual fact a challenge is a stimulus. Is that, to that stimulus, are we going to respond, to react in terms of opposition? Or are we going to maintain our balance and poise, take no sides in the matter, examine everything carefully and respond to it in the right way? Then every challenge makes us grow, brings us to our fruition. Supposing there were no challenge whatsoever in the situation in which we live, we'd perish. We'd just stagnate and die. There'd be no growth, no movement, no coming to fruition, no balance of opposing tensions at play. This is very important. So now, when the challenge is presented, there is no need to enter into conflict. Because all conflict, and particularly all conquest, sows the seeds of further conflict. That is the way of involvement, of entanglement, of greater sorrow. Greater sorrow for the very simple reason that by conflict and by conquest, understanding is not given a chance to grow. What happens in history when there's a conflict between nations? One side wins, the other side loses, as we say. And they have to end up by sitting round a table and drawing up a treaty. But the treaty is a compromise. It is not creative harmony at all. The side which has lost bides its time, gathers strength, driven by the power of hate, vengeance, the egoistic passion to assert superiority over the conqueror one day. Where does all that end? Where does it lead to? But to utter misery. And it's the same with us in our individual lives. The Gita is presented as a teaching on a battlefield. That battlefield is here, oneself. So, not the way of conflict, the way of understanding, not taking sides and observing. Then we shall see that the real meaning of the word problem is just this, that when the situation in which I am has thrown up a challenge, I have not understood the nature of that challenge, the nature of the situation, and the nature of the response which is called forth out of me. Not understanding all this, I fight. It is a problem to me. I am in a state of confusion. We all know that what we call the solution of a problem implies a state of clarity. The mind is perfectly clear. There is no entanglement, no confusion. So this is the great thing then, that the problem arises because I am in confusion. This is my problem, as I say. Oneself is the root problem of oneself. I do remember we have considered this in the past also up to a point. One can't put oneself right according to a blueprint. One just can't do it. Do this, do the other, do so and so, do so and so. All will be well in the garden. It never will be that way. Our living process is not a static situation. It is not like an engine, like a machine. Every part of us, even physically, undergoes change, growth, transformation, decay, and all the rest of it. Therefore, one has to be awake, one has to be wholly alert and watchful, and not take sides, observing the process. In order not to take sides, it becomes imperative that we be free of all our beliefs and concepts and ideas and teachings and doctrines and so forth. That is to say, we be free of our inadequate conceptions, usually misconceptions, of the great truths which are given in the teachings and the doctrines. We be free of that, free of the misconceptions. That is perhaps the most important part of it. And if we are free of those, we shall be free of the limitations imposed upon us, upon the mind, which brings about this confused state of the mind. It is our clinging to ideas, to thoughts, which is very responsible for the confused state of the mind. Thoughts, ideas will inevitably arise. They are part of a living process. No one can do away with that. But they correspond to our physical outbreathing, not to the inbreathing and the utilization of that life-giving breath inside the body. Being alert and awake, being sensitive, enables us to be receptive to the stimuli and all that they try to convey to us, the living stuff of our psychical life, so to say. And we utilize that within our own selves. And then they come out as thoughts, ideas, and so forth. Let them go. The living truth embodied in the teachings, in the doctrines, acts upon us in a way, on the whole, unbeknown to us consciously. It stimulates the living being, the living mind. And after the stimulation and the absorption of its significant, the digestion of it all in quietness, in the silence. Then what comes out in terms of actual ideas and thoughts and so forth is what is thrown out of the psyche. But we cling to that because this is what we can see. This is what we can get hold of, as we say. And because of our possessiveness, our greed to have and to hold, you see, we keep it like that. And then, of course, it's a dead weight upon us. This is where our difficulty comes. So you see, it is impossible for the mind to be anything but confused, in a state of disorder. The ordering of the mind cannot be imposed by will, by any external influence or teaching or anything like that. It has to emerge from within. If I make mistakes in the art of living, food, drink, rest, activity and so forth, what will happen to this body? It will get ill, diseased, won't it? Well, precisely that happens with the mind. And the process with the body is a living process. Food is a living thing, reacting with a living body. And it does it all on its own. I am unconscious of the process which goes on inside here. I don't know anything about it. And how, what a merciful thing it is that I don't know. Otherwise, you know the usual tendency of a human being to interfere with what is good and well, instead of leaving well alone. So now, the problem in any situation exists for me as long as I myself am in this state of disharmony and I act foolishly, taking sides, wanting to get a particular result. All my fixed criteria, evaluations, judgments, they all come to play and spoil the situation. So I have to be on the lookout for that. I can't throw them out of the window. I can only watch them as they arise in the mind. And watch them without taking sides, but just observing what is happening. And in that observing, transformation takes place by itself. If I were to impose a shape upon the nature of that transformation, woe betide me. And that's all that does betide me. Now, leave life alone. Trust life. So then you see, when one is truly in harmony, in balance inside, there is no taking of sides. There is the functioning of insight together with compassion all the time. Now, when my situation as a whole throws up the challenge, this person here, myself, is a force for producing harmony. Because this is the one and only center of harmony in the disturbed situation. Now this is what we never do. We meet the situation and we immediately say, oh, it ought to be like this, it ought to be like that. We'll twist it this way, we'll hammer it here, we'll cut it off there and perform the necessary surgical operations. And lo and behold, we have 1.5 feet in the grave already. But you know, this is the crux of the matter. This is where skill in spiritual living, in human living, therefore, comes into operation. Skill. This is the real skill that we need. Remember what we saw or tried to see last time? The healthy mind is the happy mind. If we stop chasing happiness, wisdom, perfection, love, and all the rest of it, and really see that all these things actually constitute the mind, just as my liver and heart and kidneys and nose and bones and flesh and blood constitute the body, there is nothing to obtain. They are there. I have only to remove the obstructions. Just as if I get constipated, physically, I must do something to remove the obstruction. That is all. It is like that. So, this happy mind, this healthy mind, is the capable mind, the mind at peace. The mind which does not say, oh, now here is a problem presented to me. No. Look at it this way. Here is the situation. This is the challenge which is thrown up. Just let me keep looking at the challenge. And if the mind is peaceful, healthy, and allows the power of understanding and compassion to go out, the right ideas and accompanied by the right action in that particular situation will come. You see, one has to practice it, that is all. But see what is involved in this. We have already mentioned the freedom from fixed ideas and so forth. But something rather more powerful than that. The freedom from the drive of desires, especially the unconscious, the secret desires hidden inside one. A person would say immediately, but how can I deal with that which is secret, which is hidden? I can't see it. I can't tackle it. I can't tackle what I don't see. Just keep quiet and it will show itself. You know, in a classroom, sometimes if a schoolmaster is a sufficiently wily bird, he pretends to be sort of half asleep, not noticing. That is the time that the fellows who are causing the trouble in the class get trapped and they come out into the forefront, and then you know who the demon is. Now that's what happens with our psyche also. The secret desires, the frustrations, the resentments and everything which are hidden, these demons which are awaiting their opportunity to burst forth, if I am quiet, they will come in front of me like that. They will uprise into consciousness. Then I must just look at that desire. Without judgments, for or against. Just plain observation. Not to say this is good, this is evil, and take sides with it. To see the fact that this is destructive, harmful, and so forth, and worthless, that this is not destructive, harmful, and worthless. Just to see the fact and let the forces emerge and play of themselves, they will come right. There is a self-righting tendency all throughout the cosmos, not only physically, but psychically too. This is something we forget all along the line. Just as the cells of the body are characterized, amongst other things, by this power of self-healing, the psyche as such has this self-writing element in it. It's natural to the psyche to write itself, if we let it. And it is the desires, the conscious ones as well as the unconscious ones, and especially all the frustrations and resentments of the past. We think, oh, well, all that is forgotten and forgiven and so on. We do nothing of the sort. There is nothing forgiven, nothing forgotten. The real forgiveness comes naturally into being only when, through complete insight, through one's own peaceful state, and the operation of this alchemy of compassion, that this sick psychical material gets transformed and healthy and well again. And in that is the complete forgiveness. And for that, there must be no forgetting. A forgetting is a deliberate repressing. Not forget. The Greeks knew about this very well. When they taught, when you go along your way, don't drink of the waters of the stream on the left-hand side, the waters of Lethe, of forgetfulness. Drink of the stream of memory, so that you remember everything, not forget. Most wonderful wisdom there. So you see, this business about problems which come to us all day, every day in our lives, the problems. It is a question of the right approach, the right first step. And the right first step is the only step that there is to take. I can delude myself that I'm taking several steps in a particular direction. They are not several steps. What appears as several steps is in actuality only one step. It is a little bit like this. I mean, how we should sort of look at it and understand it is a little bit like this. It is perfectly normal and natural to say that a man's heart beats 72 times per minute or whatever it may be, somewhere around 72, the healthy heart. You can count them one after the other and you say 72 heartbeats per minute. Oh, he's all right, good heart, strong heart and all the rest of it. But what is the actual phenomenon? It's a single phenomenon, the beating of the heart. Whether it be 72 beats or 62 beats or 140 beats when you're just about to land on the moon per minute, you see, it is the beating of the heart. And these are all the variations of the one thing. The apparent different steps that we take are variations of the one and only step. Now, can we see what is this one and only step? In a supreme, all-inclusive way. A one and only step. How do we look at our life and the life process, the becoming process? We look at it quite naturally because we live in space and time. We look at it as a succession of events. We are conscious all the time in terms of differentiation, of differences, of separate things. All these, this way of looking, makes us see the whole becoming process as a process of uprising and of dying, of birth and death, an alternation. Not as a single transcendent living in which birth and death are but variations which make for the appearance of change and all the rest of it, and of process. The movement of the process is an appearance. The movement through time and space is an appearance. The actual living process is just a vibrating, just here, now. So now, what is this one and only step? This is how it seems when we look at it from the outside, with our conditioning, with blinkers, by associating ourselves with the particular, the limited, the finite. Now look at it from the inside. There are multitudinous outsides to the one and only inside. When we look at the multitudinous outsides and think that we are seeing the one total reality, we are under an illusion. But if we really see and are centered in the one and only inside, which is empty, it has no characteristics. Anidarsanam, as the Buddha said. When we look at it that way, we have sort of turned round in the deepest seat of consciousness. Made a complete turning round. But it is not a turning round in this externalized sense of turning round. It is being turned inside out. That kind of turning around takes place. And in the process of this inside out turning around, there is transformation of the whole of one's awareness. So, this is the one and only step. And everything else that happens is just but a variation of this one and only step. This turning around in the deepest seat of consciousness. See that this is empty. The emptiness of the inside is seen only because of the form of the outside. And there are multitudinous outsides, but only one inside. Because this kind of inside is qualitative. Therefore it has no spatial and temporal dimensions. Whereas the outsides, form, as we call it, have spatio-temporal, limited, finite particularity. Back we come to this, looking, intensely alert looking without taking sides. That means without the operation on the volitional side, the emotional side of desire, and on the intellectual side of conceptions, assumptions, biases, prejudices. All those are out. These are the obstructions. These are the things that constipate the psyche. Then you will find that within the organism, the living organism, there is no element of a problem, something not understood within ourselves. When that is the case, then we can respond rightly. Inevitably we'll respond rightly, unconsciously practically, to the challenge presented by the situation in which we are. Now do not think that when we are in this state where there is no problem within us and the mind is quiet and poised, therefore we shall have knowledge in the worldly sense of the word knowledge. We won't. And there is no need for it. The perfect spontaneous response of the making of the perfect spontaneous response is inherent in the living being. The healthy living being, the whole living being, the pure living being. Make no mistake about that. Absolute purity of life in every respect. Then this power to make the right spontaneous response unconsciously, it's inherent in this living being. You see, look at nature, see what we can learn. When the right season comes along and the conditions are right, the plants all respond accordingly, don't they? If there is the right soil and so forth, if the soil is such that it is does not sustain the plant sufficiently well, lacks a bit of nitrogen or calcium or whatever it may be, then the plant displays such a shape and an appearance, which is the consequence of the forces at play. Otherwise, it just responds. But this response is quite unconscious. It's a living process of almost an automatic nature. This is the force at play, therefore that is the resultant. But with us it is different. The plant cannot look within itself and understand prajna or karuna or such things. It manifests prajna and karuna in its own way, unconsciously. With us, It has to be a case of coming to light within. This itself has to become a whole cosmos and get enlightened from within, and then respond as a god would respond to the world process. Is this a little bit too difficult, or are you able to get some sort of feel about it? So long as there's some sort of feel, that is sufficient. Don't try to make it a clear idea or thought, because then it'll be useless. But if the right sort of stimulus is there, through the thought, or the idea, or the spoken or written word, as the case may be, if the stimulus is there, the response of life, the unshaped, the unformed, will come out, and it'll be right. And you'll find life very zestful then. The true zest of life is in that. You watch little children playing happily. And especially if you happen to be the parent of one or more of those children. An extraordinary inward happiness. Not born of possessiveness, or this is my child business. Not just something quite indescribable, thrills inside. And you find life, oh, it's good to be alive. That sort of feeling. Life becomes zestful. And there is no grasping of it, no possessing it, no wanting to repeat it. There is freedom. You let the process go by. Now you see, this way, one is free of all problems. Problems which affect us in the destructive sense. Challenges there will always be. Challenges which bring with them the experiential elements of pain and pleasure together, or one after the other, as the case may be. That's neither here nor there. This will come inevitably, whatever you are, whatever stage you are, whoever you are, whether you be God Almighty or whether you be the world's prize idiot or villain. This will come to everybody alike. Even the Lord God has to put up his umbrella if the rain falls heavily enough. So, not that. But this, now, this turning about, this turning round in the innermost seat of consciousness. And we come back to the one and only key to it. This strenuous mindful, this arduous mindfulness, attentiveness, which for all its strenuousness, all its ardor, takes no sides, has no personal purposive movement or activity to it, but is there all the time, this immense energy and this strength of life held here now, in poise, vibrating fully, completely, without your sort of bursting out with it and squandering it. And this thing here in poise acts upon everything there, as we say. And the work of transformation goes on. But you see, it's your happiness that is involved in it. If this takes place, then happiness, bliss if you like, wisdom, truth, love, goodness, beauty, all of them in perfection flourish and are maintained through time and space. These which are spaceless and timeless manifest only through time and space. These are empty. Empty of restriction, empty of qualification. That is why they are infinite, eternal, immortal, invincible, omnipotent. But their manifestation always takes place through time and space, through the limited, through the particular. And that is each one of us, the living organism. You know, in the Maitri Upanishad, there is that extraordinary statement, samsara is just one's own thought. That is to say, the stream of thought and feeling, desire and so on, as it goes on. This is the real cycle of births and deaths, the continuous reincarnations, as commonly called. Samsara is just one's own thought. And then a little later, just a few verses later in the same Upanishad, when the mind is stilled and unto mindlessness one has come, that is the supreme state. Now this, which the Upanishad calls mindlessness, means the realization of the purity, the emptiness of mind. This is the real mindlessness. And it is in this state of mindlessness that mindfulness has come to complete fruition. Therefore, that which we call our own mind, we miscall it, but never mind, we'll use the phrase, that which we call our own mind is now completely lighted up, transparent. It offers no obstruction whatsoever to the light and power of the total reality from flowing through it. You remember we put it, we considered this in another form some months ago, that the purpose of the existence of the individual is to become a nexus, an unresisting nexus, a focus for the free inflow and outflow of transcendence. That's another way of putting the same thing. So now, let us learn to see things from the inside. If we learn to see things from the inside, we see shape, and not merely shape. We see non-shape simultaneously. The absence of shape, the emptiness of shape, That is to say, the eyes don't see non-shape. Obviously, the eyes can only see shape. But when the eyes see shape, as long as I'm in my worldly state, that is all I see. Just that little bit. That is all I'm aware of when my eyes perform the act of seeing. But if I see from the inside, I see the shape with my eyes, I am aware of the shape, the limit of the finite and the particular with my eyes, through the activity of my eyes, and I am also completely aware at the same time of the total reality. Man cannot go further than this. This is Krishnamurti's The Flight of the Eagle. The eagle in its flight does not leave a mark. The scientist does.
How true.
Inquiring into this question of freedom, there must be not only scientific observation, but also the flight of the eagle that does not leave a mark. You see, this is how it is. When we see and are conscious in the finite way, and over and above and transcending that consciousness in the finite way, we are awake and aware to this transcendent whole, then we are human. This is the full human. What's happened to all our problems? We can hardly believe that such things exist, can we? You see how important this is. In the most practical, matter-of-fact sense, there is nothing which human beings do in the ordinary way which will ever solve problems, bring peace, harmony, or the possibility of our release and fruition into full humanity, but this religious life. This is religious living. No turning away from the world in the sense of retreat from the world. We are always in the world. But we have to free ourselves from the prison house of our worldliness. Seeing, if one's inner eye is really opened, and therefore, with that, inevitably, one's heart of compassion is fully matured, one is the supreme power for good in the world. That person alone is fit to contribute to the harmonizing of man's sorrow. That sort of man doesn't attempt to remove someone else's sorrow, because then you deprive that someone else of the essential experience that is necessary for him as he is in order to learn. What do we human beings do through our existence and our life? We learn all the time. That is all. We are learning. Now, if he understood the real feeling of learning and what it means to learn, to flower out, to grow and to flower out, we would stop our foolish acquiring of knowledge, acquiring possessions, chasing sensations and excitements and all the rest of it. I went after the acquisition of knowledge. Certainly about 54 or 5 years. And then a little while ago, I dropped the load. And a little bit of light began to shine. So, that doesn't mean that one discards knowledge, throws it away. If you inherit any sort of fortune, use it rightly. Don't throw it away. That is a foolish act. It is your responsibility to be a trustee for that and use it rightly. So, knowledge, acquired knowledge, is not to be thrown away, but to be utilized rightly. And if this turning about in the innermost seat of consciousness and seeing things from the inside emerges, then it will be impossible for you not to use your knowledge rightly. You will always use it rightly. And in that lies the release of all mankind, not only of oneself. There is no such thing as oneself just by oneself. No such thing. This is our fundamental illusion. I believe when the Pali Canon presents that great insight of the Buddha after the Enlightenment, and he says, blissful is the state of him who has got rid of the conceit, the conceit meaning fancy, I am, meaning I am something separate, just like that, you see, isolated from the rest of the world. Blissful is the state of him who has got free of that. When one knows that this is the outward shape expressing the limited outward shape, the mortal outward shape expressing the infinite, immortal emptiness, which is not a vacancy, not nothingness, but empty of all restriction, of all limitation, which is the absolute freedom. When one knows that, one knows oneself and what oneself means in reality. We've put it in other forms. The one and only I is the one total reality. There is no other I. That is the only I, the one total reality. And this way lies the salvation of mankind. If we understand this properly, we can utilize all our vices for good. Sounds funny, doesn't it? I'm not for a moment suggesting indulgence in any sort of vice. any sort for going ahead with it. But in the moment of that sort of expression, which we name vice, if one is fully awake, strenuous, arduously vigilant, watchful, you will be free of that vice forever. If the intensity of the mindfulness is there. And this is where desire energy comes into right operation. The one and only desire, the bodhicitta, the longing, the passionate longing for enlightenment, the mumuksha, that passionate longing for the true liberation, which is not a liberation of me or you or anything, but which is liberation. See it from the inside. Then the yous and the I's and the he and the he's and the hers, they all vanish. And life in its magnificence, in its totality, its wholeness, really comes to fruition. See, this is the emergence into cosmos. This is the nature of emergence into cosmos. Before that, there is the unconscious, sinless state of chaos. Chaos in its true meaning. Chaos is not disorder. That's the meaning which it has come to have now. But the original meaning of chaos is the primordial condition before any patterning took place. Just the raw material of the universe, so to say. Physical and psychical. That is chaos. Then the energy is set to work and make shapes and patterns. And then we call that a cosmos. Because this we can observe from the outside. Chaos we cannot observe from the outside. Chaos is not evil in its original meaning. It is the raw material out of which everything comes. Now we live in cosmos. And chaos and cosmos continuously interact, interplay with each other. And the same thing happens in us too. Although the body as such is a highly organized thing, altogether a cosmos as such, but that element which we call chaos is also here and now operative and interacting with this cosmos. As long as we as individuals remain unawake, unintelligent, confused, distracted, dissipating, squandering our energies and so forth, this interplay is a sad interplay. It is a wrong interaction. But when we awake, we can draw upon the infinite resource of chaos. And we draw upon it not through the conscious mind, but it gets drawn through the unconscious functioning of that energy, that power, which we name mind. This is the kind of thing, it seems to me, which happens with the living individual. But in awakening to this, you awaken to a marvel and a wonder of existence, the like of which no fairy tale, no wishful thinking can ever present to you. I'll give you just one little example. Just a few days ago, early in the morning, I was awake very early. It was about 5:30, and I just got up quietly, drew the curtains, and sat down, looking out onto the lawn and the flowers and so on, and those trees. And of course, the sun had risen by now, you see, the light coming through. And my mind was just quietly wandering in this manner. We humans can know this thing, and those trees and so forth are unconscious. And suddenly it came to me. Everything has mind. Everything has sensitivity. Those trees know, those insects, those birds, that grass, that soil, it knows in its way and is aware of me in its way, which I know nothing about. And you know, it didn't come as a thought. It just sort of came like that. And it's the kind of occasion on which suddenly there is the living reality of the one total unity, which is the one total reality. And in that is a peace and a love and a wonder and a thrilling and an immensity of energy and power, the like of which one rarely experiences. These things come again and again, you know, and they fill your life with real beauty and wonder. No taking sides then. How can one take sides? Whose side shall I take? The side of the bird which swooped down and picked up the little worm for its food? That is the way. This is how totality functions. Totality in its aspect of appearance, of multitudinous shapes and forms, they feed upon each other like that. But inside, look at it from the inside, the emptiness, and the whole thing is embraced in one vast economy of the cosmic process. And it's a miracle.